all, and welcome back to another episode of the podcast, dropping during this two-week holiday season of Christmas and New Year's. You know I love me a good scientist, and I'm always looking for someone to interview who might indulge my scientific whimsies. And this week, I was lucky. I got to interview Bert Terhart. And I mean, he's not only a scientist, he's also a soldier, a sailor, adventurer, and serial entrepreneur. So when I say that this human being contains multitudes, he probably contains more than multitudes. And I'm not sure where they're all stuffed inside of him, because he really is a fabulously complex and intelligent man. Now, Bert and I had a great conversation. In this episode, we bring up killer whales, we bring up the ocean, we talk about danger, we talk about making good decisions, we talk about what it looks like to go out into the world and have an adventure, or maybe begin a journey that absolutely terrifies you. He has had a lifelong passion for the oceans and oceanography, and he has advanced degrees in math, physics, and physical oceanography. So when I'm saying scientist, I mean Bert hits all the right buttons for me. It was a great conversation, and Bert is such an incredible human being with so many fabulous stories. So I hope you enjoy this episode as you're wrapping your presents and maybe baking those last Christmas cookies. And I'll see you on the flip side when the next episode drops. But until then, you have this episode and my conversation with Bert.
After an hour of traveling, the first thing you're looking for is a place to stay, because the weather can drive you off the river or the lake. There could be a storm. I was on the outskirts of a tornado and a hurricane. So it rained 9 out of 10 days that I was gone for the 6.5 months. So finding shelter is extremely difficult. And without shelter, you're just dead man walking.
Question, and I'm ever so intrigued by your answer, is how do you self-describe? If you had to go to a party or you had to go to a conference, you had to introduce yourself to people, how would you do that?
Okay, well, I would say something like soldier, scientist, serial entrepreneur, adventure explorer.
Wow, you've got that. It's a really nice, tight little nugget that you can just drop there about who you are. You know, sometimes I follow it up with, as a kid, did you have an affinity for science? Did you love science?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I wanted to do was I wanted to get on a boat and I wanted to go study the ocean. That's what I wanted to do. I had a friend. I shouldn't say a friend because that's very casual. I met this guy when we were in grade 3. He's still my best friend. We've been business partners for almost, 20 years now, 2 decades. He's a wildly successful medical doctor and researcher. And all he ever wanted to do was be a biologist. I just wanted to get on a boat and go to sea and then be a scientist. And all he ever wanted to do was be a biologist. So somehow growing up in central Canada, I grew up 9 miles north of the U.S. border and probably 120 miles away from Fargo, North Dakota, which most people can relate to. So somehow in that, growing up in the middle of literally nowhere on this, vast, flat expanse of nearly nothingness, we would spend our time as kids, doing the biology thing, which is, finding tadpoles and getting, swamp water and looking at it under a microscope and then looking for fossils. And then on the nearby lake, we'd get on we'd make a boat and go paddling or something like that. So somehow we were able to foster both those, proclivities when we were very young, and they've remained. Actually, it's really interesting that they've remained, and I think that's true for just about everybody.
I do want to confess right now that once I got on a sailboat on Lake Michigan and I just wanted to hurl the entire time. So that was Lake Michigan. Okay. I also took the Queen Mary. I did have scopolamine patches behind my ear.
Correct.
I did okay with that. But I do not do well on the ocean. Have you been, do you ever get seasick?
Oh, I think everybody can get seasick. It's just if you haven't been seasick, then you just haven't been in the conditions that would make you sick. So astronauts, for example, back in, you know, when they were first becoming astronauts, they were all test pilots. They were all, you know, they were all fighter pilots, which meant that they were some of the people most highly acclimated to those conditions that would normally make you sick, but they were never sick. The minute you get in space, everyone gets sick. So they get motion sickness regardless. Even a fighter pilot will get motion sickness. He just hasn't been in those conditions yet. So seasickness it affects everyone. You can, of course, acclimatize to it, but no one is immune. So.
And do you have any idea where this kind of passion and this desire to, like, you know, go study the ocean, be on the ocean, where it came from?
Well, I'm Dutch. So my parents immigrated to Canada when my father in 52 and my mom in 1956 when they got married. But everybody my mom and my dad's family, they were all in the Dutch Merchant Marine, every single one of them. So my father, my grandfather, my grandfather's father, everybody on my mom's, I shouldn't say, and not everybody on my mom's side, a good portion of my mom's side were also in the Dutch Merchant Marine. So, and my father, he sailed and rowed to school. So it's in my blood. It's literally in my blood. And that isn't true for my siblings. Like I have a brother and two younger sisters, and they're not crazy sailors by any stretch of the imagination. Although they can all sail, they've all, you know, grew up in the water, but I'm the only one that sort of, I hate to say never grew up, but I'm the one that never grew out of it. Like I can say that.
I give two thumbs up to never growing up. I just want to put that out there. So I'm excited that you have this passion. You found it at an early age and then you followed through and you continue to follow through, because so many of us, when we grow up, you know, our parents are kind of like pat us on the head and they are like, it's time to grow up, you know, put away childish things, step into the world. But you've really, in this gorgeous way, been able to continue your, you know, friendship, you could say, your connection to the ocean, and have a vocation out of it. So how did you do that?
Well, I when you asked me what, you know, how I would self-describe, I said soldier, sailor, scientist, serial entrepreneur, adventure explorer. And that's the path that I've been on. So your path might very well stray from what you think you might, you know, what you might describe as your purpose or your destiny. I mean, use some big terms, I guess, or some broad terms, but you know, being a soldier, I was in the Canadian Special Service Force. So it's the equivalent of sort of the Green Berets, I guess, or maybe Delta Force or something like that, which is as far removed from, you know, being an oceanographer, being an academic and a scientist as you can imagine. But that just happened to be part of my journey. So and I wasn't given a choice in that matter. That's just the way it was going to be. And but that doesn't mean that your dreams need to be crushed. So, and that's my point. So you mentioned something that I find really interesting was that, you know, when if you're a child, every time you step out the front door, you know, you're going to the moon, or you're, you know, you're traveling around the world, or you're, you know, you've got some wild, crazy adventure, some giant trip you're going to be on. And all you've done is step outside your front door and close the door behind you. Well, my idea of adventure and exploration is no different than that at all. The only thing that happens, I think, as adults is that somehow that gets dragged out of us. I mean, literally, that's idea of adventure and you know, your dreams and all those things gets dragged out of you kicking and screaming. And then the farther it gets away from us, the the more remote and impossible it seems. But I just never allowed that to happen. So, I mean, I viewed my time, you know, in the service as just one giant adventure. Although it was, I mean, it was fantastic, and I got and the benefit I got from that was incalculable. But it was still an adventure. And then becoming a scientist was another adventure. And then becoming an entrepreneur, another adventure. So all these things are, I'm sort of on this same sort of thread. And of course, sometimes you might be pointed a little bit differently than you might wish to be pointed. But I never lost sight of the fact that life was supposed to be an adventure. And the mistake that we typically make is that has to happen at some grandiose scale. We think it has to be something, well, I'll use the word extraordinary, but I'm cheating because when if I were to say to you extraordinary, you automatically think of something like, let's say LeBron James, who's an extraordinary basketball player. He wasn't born into the NBA. He came into the NBA and he came into the NBA like every other professional athlete by doing a little bit outside the ordinary. That little tiny bit. So extra doesn't mean massive. It can mean anything, you know, between a little tiny bit and something huge. So in order to get, you know, in order for LeBron James, you know, or any athlete or any entrepreneur or anyone to do anything that we might look at to be extraordinary, that person decided at one point just to do something a little bit outside the ordinary, a little tiny bit, and then do it consistently. That's how you become a professional musician. That's how you come, you know, that's how you can, you know, sail around the world at basically a slow walk or paddle across a continent. That's how you get things done. So what we just tend to think of as the extraordinary is this great big, well, that isn't how you get there. You get there with these little tiny things. And you get those little tiny things happen when you step out your front door. So that first step is the most important one. You know, as kids, we're just blind to that. You know, we just step outside the front door and suddenly it's, you know, it's Mars, right? Literally Mars. I'm walking around on Mars now. Or you're in the Tour de France, you know, because you're riding a bike. Or, I mean, I grew up in Canada, so everyone's a, you know, every time you put on a pair of skates, you're always scoring the, you know, the overtime goal in the seventh game of the Stanley Cup, right? If you're a football player, you're always catching the winning pass, right? Or whatever the case is. And that happens immediately as soon as you step outside that front door.
I love everything you're saying. I just want to put that out there. I'm a huge fan of staying, you know, kind of having that mindset of being playful and every day is an adventure, even though, you know, you're like, why does my knee hurt today as I crawl out of bed? I'm just going to pivot really quickly here.
Sure.
Just because you're an oceanographer, do you have a favorite ocean going animal?
Oh, sure. Sure. The favorite ocean-going animal is an albatross.
Is it because of their wingspan?
No, it's because they spend the vast majority of their life at sea, and they're the most beautiful, the most graceful. I remember looking out, you know, being on the boat in the middle of the wildest weather that you can imagine, where the boat is mostly underwater and you're mostly afraid for your life, and then you see this the albatrosses are just. It's just another day in the park for them. And they're beautiful to watch fly. They are incredibly graceful. And they have this, and they're wonderful company because as soon as the wind stops blowing, then they stop flying because they, you know, they don't want to expend all that energy. If there's no wind, then the sailboat's not going. So the albatross are always floating around the boat. So you get to know them. You actually get to know them by their markings. And what I like about them is that there's this duplicity about them duplicity isn't the right word. There's this dualism about them. There are these amazing flyers. It's incredibly graceful. And then when they land, it's like someone just took a bunch of, you know, emptied the laundry basket over the side of the boat. Cause they're flying. And then suddenly they're crashing. So there's a humility about them. I think that they may or may not be aware of, but that's a constant reminder of me to be humble because, you know, they simply are what they are, and they're not good at everything, and they don't always look amazing. And
Yeah, I remember watching documentaries about them and I, you know, just hearing they spend most of their lives at sea. And I thought, what? Mm-hmm. What does that mean? Oh my God. Because, you know, I think, I mean, home is such an inbred thing in like humans. Like, what is home? Yeah. Where do we belong? All of this stuff. And you could say that the albatrosses belong to the sea because that is essentially their home if they're there most of the time. You know, they're not laying their eggs in the sea. They do have to go somewhere else to do that. But honestly, I mean, in their wingspans, they're just like gorgeously amazing. Mm-hmm. When they're in the sky, regal, just glorious animals. And then I love that your analogy of the laundry basket, dumping the laundry out, because, you know, we all have to be kind of, you know, a mess sometimes.
Oh yeah. 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 And what's interesting you say about home, because, yes, they're at sea all the time, but, they're at home because they are surrounded by community. So there's, you know, they're solitary creatures, but whenever there's no wind, they'll gather. So you know, they won't be just one floating and then another one floating 5 miles away. They'll just all congregate. So there is a very strong sense of community that you can sense when you see them like that, which is true for humans. Like, you know, what's home? Well, if you could be your wife, your kids, your extended family, that's home. And you can actually pack up and go to a different country. In the case of my parents, and create a new home. You know, you can think of shelter as perhaps, you know, the physical roof over your head, or it could be, you know, the shelter could be found in your community, which could be, of course, your immediate family or whatever the case might be. So when you say that they're, you know, they're at sea, so their home is the sea, which is this huge mass, this amorphous mass, but then they have this very tight sense of community. And I think you can tell that's what they consider to be home. I don't speak albatross very well. So,
well, I'm starting to learn on the Duolingo app. So just to let you know.
Okay.
I wanted to ask and pose this question to you. It's a little bit of a silly question, but I would love to know if you had a specialty when you were an oceanographer, when you were studying the ocean, and can you give any rhyme or reason that boats are being attacked? I think it's by killer whales and sunk. Mm-hmm. I would love to hear your ideas, suppositions on that.
All right. So my specialty in oceanography was, I was a physical oceanographer. So I studied long period waves in the ocean. So when I say long period waves, they have wavelengths, the length of an entire ocean basin, which is, you know, which is something like El Nino, because, you know, people know what El Nino and La Nina is. And, because I was a physicist, I was entirely involved with, you know, with applied math and modeling. So these large period oceanic waves. So I'm just qualifying my answer because I'm not a marine biologist, although I am a sailor, and I've been surrounded by whales. Just about every time you go sailing along the coast, certainly here in British Columbia, you're going to see whales. So I've seen, you know, minke whales, blue whales, sperm whales. I've seen humpback whales. I've seen killer whales. I've seen resident killer whales in porpoises and dolphins and, you know, all these things. So I've been around them a lot. I've been close enough to touch them at sea. I've had killer whales. I've had juvenile killer whales play around the boat for hours and hours and hours. You can literally hear them asking permission from their mom to play, because, you know, the pod will be over here. The boat will attract attention. The little guy will come over and start playing around the boat, which is, you know, he'll pop up and look at it, and then he'll come by and he'll rub up against it, and then he'll just sort of, you know, cavort around the bow. And then you'll hear the mom sonify, like she'll call. He'll answer, or she. Mom will come over. They'll have a conversation with each other. They'll have a conversation with the boat because mom wants to know what the boat is. So, which means that she'll get beneath it and just blast it with, you know, with sound to get some idea of how dense it is and, you know, what's there. And then she'll go back to the pod, and then the little guy will stay, and then mom will call back for dinner. So you can hear this. If you have kids, this is a conversation you have with your kids all the time. So I guess that's a long way of, I've had killer whales patrol a boat. I've had them, I've had killer whales. There'd be a bunch of killer whales oh, in this particular instance, there was a large group of killer whales that was behind and to the right. So they were about maybe half a mile away, and they were behaving very strangely. Because I mean, I've been sailing here for a long time, and we did killer whale research actually when I was a graduate student. One of the things that we did was, there was photographers taking pictures of their saddle patch, which is the white patch right behind their dorsal fin. And it's like a fingerprint. So if you get a picture of that, you know what whale that is. And every pod has its own dialect. So we had hydrophones in the water listening to, you know, to what pod that was there, and trying to understand something about their speech and vocal patterns, and then identify them. So I was in the small boats that was part of the survey. So this was behavior I'd never seen. I'd never seen this, you know, in enclosed waters, and never seen it at sea. And while my attention was focused over my shoulder, I heard this very silent breathing. And I look over on the left-hand side of the boat, and there's two killer whales that are just right beside the boat. And they're looking at me because they've got one big eye, and they're not breathing like they normally breathe. Like normally you can hear them, you know, a long ways away, but they're breathing very softly in the same way that, you know, that you would be breathing softly if somebody was in the, you know, somebody was nearby that you didn't want them to know that you were there. So I very quickly got the impression that if I didn't keep doing what I was doing, like going in that direction and, you know, turned around to bother whatever, you know, what was going on over there, like crash the party, literally, then these people, these whales would have rushed off and said, you know, we got to go somewhere else because this guy's not behaving, you know, correctly. So they're incredibly intelligent. So that's a long-winded way of me saying that these attacks aren't random at all. There's only been one killer whale. There was a killer whale that was attacking boats on the west coast of Canada. It's quite famous. This was in a landlocked area, and it was first playing with boats, and then it got more and more and more aggressive, until finally it was damaging boats because they're huge animals. They're not small, and eventually no one quite knows what happened to that whale, but it probably ran afoul of a tugboat. My point is that the whales that are attacking boats in the Strait of Gibraltar, they've probably been traumatized in one way, shape, or form. They may have been, most likely they had a run-in of some description with another small boat. And this would be a behavior that in my estimation is just trying to make sure that they're trying to teach all these other boats to stay away, in the same way that these two whales were following me to make me, you know, to make sure that I was behaving correctly. And if I was going to do something other than be a human, it was going to go and tell someone. So, and of course it's tough to teach, a fiberglass sailboat anything. They don't learn very quickly.
Before we get to the second question, I know we haven't even gotten to the second question, but yeah. Okay. So as someone who studies waves, mm-hmm. I'm sure you know about those waves that sailors reported for decades that were 60 to 100 feet high in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, they'd make these reports and people would say, okay, you're lying, or were you on drugs, or you imagined all of that. But no, what we now do have video proof of these massive, massive, massive waves that mm-hmm. are, you know, just all of a sudden they're there. So now as a physicist, mm-hmm. because physics deals with waves.
Yes.
So is there a corollary in physics for these anomalous 100-foot waves in the ocean? And I'm sure it has to do with math.
Yeah, it's completely math. It's simply a superposition of different waveforms. I guess the best way to explain it is, let's say that you have two people jumping on a trampoline, right? And they can jump. They cannot be synchronized, so that nothing really happens. They're both sort of jumping at the same height, but if suddenly they become in sync, then the height that they can go, the amplitude of their jump goes up dramatically. Well, exactly the same thing happens you know, exactly the same thing happens in music. Exactly the same thing happens in the ocean. So it's every wave that is driven by gravity. So a spring is driven by gravity. You know, basically, there's no such thing as a rogue wave. That's been made popular by Hollywood, which is why I was smiling. But there are massive waves in the ocean. I've seen them with my own eyes. They don't necessarily appear out of nowhere. Even the way that waves are described in the ocean, if you go to the wave forecast, NOAA's wave forecast, they'll give you the statistical height of the wave. They'll say the waves are 8 meters. Well, when they give you the statistical wave height, it's simply a way of saying that if you were to look out, you know, from your position over the horizon, almost all the waves that you see will be 8 meters. One out of every 100 waves will be 12 meters, you know, basically 50% higher. And one out of every 1,000 meters is going to be 16 meters, which is a big difference, right? So you have a 20-foot wave, or you have, you know, basically a 55-foot wave. Well, that's a massive difference, right? So, and it apparently just shows up out of nowhere, but that's just a function of the fact that you have on the surface of the ocean, you have all these people jumping on the trampoline. And every now and then they suddenly just get together and this happens, and they get out of sequence, and then this happens again. I mean, the highest recorded waves have been in the order of 140 feet. I mean, basically, the way that I would describe it in a typical ocean storm, you basically go out and stand in the Southern Ocean, go out and stand across the street from a 6-story apartment building and mm-hmm. look at the roof. So that's what's coming at you. So you're standing up looking at, you know, 60 feet, and it's coming at you at about, you know, 35 or 40 miles an hour.
I was going to say, you know, I would just really be seasick at that point if I saw like a six-story apartment building with water coming towards me.
Well, I mean, there's if you see that, you might have other things to worry about. So maybe being seasick might be pretty low on your list of things to get done that day. So, but.
Okay, well, let me get to the second question, which is, did you grow up in a religious household? What did that look like for you? And how has that changed as you've gotten older or formed a relationship with the world and the ocean and what have you?
Well, I think I grew up in a fairly religious household. We were very traditional. I mean, Dutch people tend to be very traditional. We were Protestant. There's not much, I mean, there wasn't a lot of choice, I suppose, in a very small town. So, you know, I went to church, you know, every Sunday, and I went to Sunday school and all those things. And I left home when I was pretty early. And then in the military, at least in Canada, there was, you know, there was still church every Sunday. There was still this, I guess, because part of it is that you're supposed to be, I mean, as a soldier, we have to be comfortable with that your own mortality is very much hanging in the balance. So, But as an adult and you know, I guess as an older adult and then you know, moving through science and everything, religion became more, I won't say as an academic exercise, but then you still have to learn something about it. So then you can't be religious in a vacuum, in my estimation. And of course, I think that to really appreciate and be grateful for what we have in this country, it behooves you to have some understanding and perspective of what other people have in their country. So that means, you know, learn something about their culture, learn something about their religion, learn something about their morals and their practices and all these things. I'm trying to read around Christianity, but then I've come back doing what I've done, putting myself in those positions, in those places where, you are not at all, you're not far removed from God at all. I mean, I've written about them as being very thin places. And every major religious tradition in the world has this idea that a prophet or someone, not that I'm claiming to be a prophet, please don't get me wrong, but they head off into the wilderness to find something. And they don't know what that is. So they leave and they go, they face the unknown or the chaos, literally, the nature, clearly God's creation, but still, and not malevolent, but it doesn't necessarily have your best interests at heart, because like a 50-foot wave will just wipe you out and not lose if they sleep at all, they're not going to lose a moment of it. Or you can get eaten by a bear, the bear doesn't care, right? You know, there's a chaotic element to, you know, to being in the wilderness, but they voluntarily go out there and they go out there seeking. It's an adventure. It's literally an exploration. So I think that we're actually called to this. I think we're actually called, you know, to seek. So it's a long-winded way of me saying, yes, it's incredibly obvious. It is beyond obvious when you are reduced to the simplest things that that make you human. Everything about civilization, as you know, it is taken away. Everything, every idea you have about being comfortable is taken away. Everything you know about community is taken away. Everything you know about communicating with other human beings is pretty much taken away. You know, your shelter is taken away, and you know, food and warmth is all gone. And it's not hard to do that. It's just gone. So what's left? Well, that's a really good question, right? What's left when all that is gone? So, and if you choose to do that, if you choose to seek sort of in that way, or at least expose yourself in some small way, you don't have to do this at a great big scale. Like you can literally do this, you know, outside your front door. If you step outside the door with an open heart and open mind, I think that you're going to find things that are going to, that will be transformative in every way that you can imagine and in ways that you cannot possibly imagine. Of course, like I said, you find yourself in this very thin place. There's virtually nothing separating you from there's very little separating you from the divine. You can feel it. I've seen it with my own eyes. I've been blessed with, I snuck around the world. I didn't sail around the world. I snuck around the world. Hopefully nobody would notice. And the same thing with getting across Canada, the same thing sailing up into the, you know, the Bering Sea and the Aleutian Islands and all those places. You're literally there by the grace of God. And that sounds, you hear that all the time, and it sounds so trite and simplistic. But when you're, as you alluded to, you're looking around at waves that are the size of apartment buildings crashing around, and they're not where you are. And, you know, they could very well be. And why is that? And why were you spared? And, you know, and it, when everything around you is nothing but desolation, how is it that you're there? So there's this interesting juxtaposition, which I guess just kind of brings this full circle, is that you're in these places that are where you are incredibly humbled, because you are you're not even a grain of sand. You're less than a grain of sand.
I wanted to ask you, with all the sailing that you've done and all the trips that you've planned around sailing, for you, what was kind of maybe before you even started, you thought, this is totally bonkers, but I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah, that's the solo nonstop around the world. It's ridiculously crazy. When I told my dad, the first thing he said was, I thought you were smarter than that. So which was very sage advice, way better than, you know, you got this or anything. Let me give you some idea of how hard that is. So 6,000 people have climbed Everest, 600 people have been in space, 300 people have sailed nonstop around the world, 9 have done it with a sextant. I mean, that's no electronic navigation at all. I'm the 9th, and only one person in the world has ever sailed solo nonstop using a sextant, leaving from the West Coast of North America. So it's ridiculously hard, and you have to be unbelievably lucky. And the chances of you succeeding are virtually nil, because so much can go wrong. Nothing about it makes any sense. Like if you had any real brains, you wouldn't do it, I think. It's just about the hardest thing a human can do. It's just about the hardest thing that a human can do. I was gone for 9 months, like just about everybody else who, you know, sails around the world nonstop, alone, nothing, no one to talk. There's no communication. You leave the dock alone. The person that was my shore party was my sister. That's one. And then you step off the boat and okay, you're home now. But you know, that said, I've just always chosen things that are hard. This idea of suffering, this idea of duty, this idea of sacrifice and service is not very far removed from, well, Joseph Campbell, I suppose, would say our typical, you know, hero story. They know the myth, the hero with a thousand faces kind of thing. But there's a moral imperative for doing the hard things. And that's, okay, let's look at a simple example. Say, today I want to go to the gym. I have a big trip planned in the summer. You know, I need to go to the gym, but I know it's harder. I could lay on the couch and watch Netflix, right? Or I could stand up. What's harder? Well, I should probably stand up. Stand up. Then I look around and then I go, what's harder?
I was gonna say, I know the answer to this question.
Yeah. So, I mean, you just keep doing it until you get out the door, in the car, you know, and into the gym, whatever the case might be. And I mean, as crazy as that analogy sounds, I've used that in good stand in every aspect of my life. Soldier, sailor, scientist, serial entrepreneur, adventurer, explorer. As long as the trajectory is upward, like there's something good about, you know, I mean, I'm only asking for trouble if I decide to do what I want to do next summer and I'm out of shape.
Right.
Like I'm not serving anybody. I'm not myself, right. You know, my nothing. Right. So there's a moral imperative to, you know, to be pointed that way. So.
Yeah. There's a moral imperative to roll off the couch because that's how I would get off the couch.
Well, then that's still harder than lying there. Right. So.
It's true.
Very, very briefly. When you will be scared, right? It doesn't matter what you decide to chew off, you will be scared. And the way to combat that fear is simply to boil it down into one of two choices that's brain dead simple, that you cannot, your body really can't physically distinguish between two great things. Because if I said to you, you have to sail around the world to the Southern Ocean and it's going to be nothing but storm after storm, you'd go, well, that's not doing that. That's just way too hard. But if I said, well, why don't you just go down to the boat and, you know, see if the ropes are still tight, then you'd do that, right? So I would say, literally, I would be strapped down strapped down to the boat because the motion is so violent that you can't stand up and walk without 4 points of contact. So that's two hands and both feet and hopefully a hip. I'd say, I have to get outside because the boat's going to come apart unless I do something. I know I have to do something. So that's the trajectory upwards, you know? So what am I going to, I said, like, I think I can get to the place where I can get dressed, because to get dressed means that you've got to use both hands, which means that you're going to be flying across the boat and potentially hurt yourself. But right now I'm strapped down to my little bunk and I'm fine. And the little voice inside your head says, you know, stay there, you're safe, stay, you're safe. And of course, you know, that's wrong. So I'd say, well, I wonder if I can get my boots on. And then it would take 20 minutes to get my boots on. And I wonder if I can get my, you know, my rain pants on. Another 20 minutes to get, maybe I can get my jacket on. Because it would take me an hour and a half to get dressed in those conditions.
Wow. Oh my gosh. Okay. Oof, I can't even imagine. I don't want to imagine it, so I'm going to stop right now.
Yeah.
Me sick. Well, I need to ask the central question of the podcast, which is, sure. I would love to hear one or two or three stories, however many you feel like you want to share, about something that you considered to be either magical, miraculous, mysterious, sure, that's happened in your life, something inexplicable that you'd like to share. It can be as many as you want or one, whatever you feel comfortable with.
Okay. So there's all kinds. So let me start. One of my favorite experiences when I was sailing on this round the world trip was I was in the Southern Indian Ocean, which is a very difficult place to sail. The Southern Ocean is the most extreme marine environment on the planet and potentially the most extreme environment period. Cause even in Antarctica, you can stand, you can stand on the snow and survive for a long time. If you step off the boat, you're done. So, and of course the weather's, so anyway, it's a very, very, very tough place. Then it was between storms. So, and the storms come just one after the other, And there's very little respite. And there was this time I knew it. I had just weathered this storm. And the one that was coming along was going to be worse, which is what happens as you get farther. And anyway, so I knew I was in for it. I was outside and it was early in the afternoon, and I was feeling sorry for myself because, you know, and as useless as that is, I was feeling sorry for myself. So, and D.H. Lawrence said that I've never seen a wild thing sorry for itself. A small bird will drop frozen dead from a bough without ever having felt sorry for myself. So I was struggling, right? Because I knew that this wasn't struggling in the sense that this was, these emotions weren't constructive. They weren't conducive. And of course, it's very hard to, it's easy to, you know, to sink into a morass of your own emotions because there's no one else. There's no checks and balances. There's just you. So I needed to make sure that I was prepared for what was coming next, because what was coming next was, I knew what that was going to look like. And I'm not, you know, I'm a technical guy. So I've been a programmer and a, you know, scientist and, you know, typical, you know, male, you know, like 1 + 1 = 2. And, you know, everything's black and literally, I mean, everything's black and white. So I'm thinking that there's, and you've always heard the expression all the time that there's the ocean has no, you know, the ocean has her own moods. And I had always just dismissed that. Okay, that's crazy. I mean, I'm a scientist. I know these things and I'm a sailor and that's nothing but, you know, solving math problems, the whole thing. So I'm in the cockpit feeling sorry for myself and looking out over the ocean. And of course, if you look out over the ocean for months and months and months, you get to be very familiar with, you know, the ocean. And suddenly the whole surface of the sea just changed. And it changed as fast as the expression on your face when I said that, changed like this. And I looked at it and I thought, I couldn't believe what I had seen. I couldn't believe it. I had no explanation for it. And I looked and looked and looked, and the ocean had literally changed her mood. It is exact. The only way that I can describe it is if the hand of God had passed over the surface of the ocean in an instant. And had I been down below, I would have missed it. And if I hadn't been looking sort of with a, you know, I think with an open heart and an open mind, then I would have missed it. Because like I said, I was feeling sorry for myself and I was, you know, I was asking, where am I going to find the strength? Where am I going to do this? How am I going to do it? I'm not even halfway through. I'm 15,000 miles away from anywhere. And the nearest person to me is 200 miles that way in the International Space Station. I'm thousands and thousands of miles from land. Like there's nothing there. And suddenly the hand of God passes over the surface of the ocean. It just changes her mood completely. And it just seeps into me like, well, it pours into you as if you were an empty bucket. And then it's gone just like that again. And in that moment, I realized, well, maybe I'm not so much of a, maybe I'm more of a romantic than I think I am. And most certainly the ocean can change your moods. Now because I saw it, and I would never have seen it otherwise. I would call it a miracle. We're surrounded by miracles every waking moment of the day, but that was certainly one that you know, certainly got, you know, punched me in the face. And the other one I would say similarly was that, you know, paddling across the country, that was, again, I mean, that's pretty tough. Canada is almost all wilderness. And if you choose to walk across it or paddle across it, it's very much unchanged than it was, say, 200 years ago. And it's very difficult to find a place to stay because I was living in a tent that was no bigger than, you know, packed up. It was less than a pound because that's all I could carry. It was this big, all rolled up. So you can't just, you know, you can't just stay everywhere because firstly, it's a riverbank and typically a riverbank or maybe a lake. And there's the shore is completely inhospitable and rugged and wild and crazy within the first hour of when you leave. So I'm paddling maybe 10 or 12 hours a day. Or walking or whatever I need to do to get across the country. And after an hour of traveling, the first thing you're looking for is a place to stay because the weather can drive you off the river or the lake. There could be a storm. I was on the outskirts of a tornado and a hurricane. So it rained 9 out of 10 days that I was gone for the 6.5 months. So finding shelter is extremely difficult. And without shelter, you're just dead man walking. Like literally, you're just not going to make it. So shelter is incredibly important. So every hour, after the first hour of traveling, I'm immediately looking for, because I might have to get off the river. I might have to stay where I am. Maybe I can't get around. Maybe something's broken. So there's all kinds of things that go wrong. And the first thing you have is shelter. and you're completely exposed, not like the big boat where there's, you know, there's a cabin. Now there's just nothing. So I worried about this constantly. Like I would, at every hour I would be grading potential campsites, right? So out of a scale of five, so that I knew that if I came to one that was say a 5 out of 5 and it was late in the day, I would get off at the 5 out of 5. And if I hadn't seen a campsite, you know, that was above a 2 in the last 3 hours and I came across a 3, I was getting off the water at the 3 because the chances of not me seeing anything better were very low. So I had this, I'm constantly, you know, playing. So there's a lot of, you know, emotion and anxiety and energy that goes into that. And I realized that every time I needed a place to get off, there was always a place to get off. Every time. Every time I needed one, it was right there. And I thought, wait a second, you know, it's what's in the Bible. Like, you know, the birds never worry about, they're not worried. Why should you be worried, basically, to butcher that piece of scripture horribly? So I stopped worrying about it completely. I said, whatever I need, it will be provided. I just have to accept that. And it's easy to say that. It's something else to be mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually aligned with that belief. That's the only way that you can succeed in anything, is that you need to be aligned in those four ways, you know, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and physically. If you become misaligned in any one of those, then your chances of success start to degrade. And if you're misaligned in all four, then it's going to be miserable. So I became aligned with the fact that whatever I needed, I would find, and whatever circumstance I was in, that was the correct circumstance. So it was tremendously uplifting, right? To actually realize that in the deepest way. So you hear this all the time in popular literature and culture that you have to live in the now, but that's almost impossible to do in our culture, where we're bombarded by things 24/7. Like my phone is going off at 3 a.m, you know, when clients on the East Coast are calling me. So it happens all the time. So it's hard to be embedded in the now. But embedded in the now, part of that is that you're physically, that you're aligned completely and faithful, and that whatever you need is going to be provided. So I think that to me, that was one of the most, it was one of the most beautiful realizations of the, you know, of the canoe trip. And it manifests itself not just in shelter, but it manifests in finding food. It manifests in being lost. Like, cause I only used a map and a compass, no electronic navigation, and it's a wilderness. So, you know, just go out in the woods sometime and have a look around. Like most people won't get in the car without, you know, these days, without the phone telling them which way to the grocery store. So now imagine that there's nothing. Like most people actually aren't afraid of losing sight of, they're not afraid of going to sea. They're afraid of losing sight of land. Because once you lose sight of land, there's no more navigational direction. There's no way to tell you which way to go anymore. Like at least if you can see the top of the mountain, you guys should probably head over there. Everything else is just a wilderness. So, you know, losing sight of land, being lost is it's a very primal fear. It lives in every one of us. All you have to do is, leave your phone at home. You can get an idea what that might be like. So,
yeah, I was actually, when I walked the Camino in 2013 in France,
There you go.
Yes, they actually, in the middle of the forest, they were doing some clearing of land. So they cleared they cut down the actual signpost that was supposed to tell me which way to turn. So I blazed right past it and all of a sudden found myself somewhere in the French woods, but also on this weird, like, logging road.
Yeah.
And it was raining and it was so cold. France had the worst weather they had in 90 years. I could feel myself becoming hypothermic because it was so cold and I was just getting, so I just kept walking. And I realized I'm not anywhere near where I'm supposed to be. I have no clue where I am.
Yeah.
And so eventually I bumped into this really small village and I crawled under this person's like garage or whatever. My hands would barely work, but I got my phone out of and I did not have Wi-Fi in France, but somehow for like 2 or 3 minutes, I was able to access the map app
and
look at where I was supposed to be versus where I was in this village where no one was coming out to say, are you okay? And I found myself on a highway and I walked to where I was supposed to be. But I mean, I was drenched. I played around with putting, you know, just erecting my tent in the woods and my rain fly and everything. And I thought, no, you're too cold and everything's mm-hmm. soaked and you will die potentially. You have mm-hmm. to keep walking. And mm-hmm. so I did. And that's what saved me is like, I did not stop walking. Also, I didn't get hit on the French highway, which is another miracle, because those people drive crazy, kind mm-hmm. of like they drive in New Mexico, a little mm-hmm. crazy. So I was so grateful when I got to where I was supposed to be and I took a hot shower and then I literally just passed out in bed. I was like,
well, there's a couple really amazing things about that story that just warm my heart. Is one of them is that when you're faced with a decision that's really, really dire. So do I set up my tent or do I keep walking? No matter how hard keep walking is. And you make that decision like this. It's easy at that time in that circumstance. But if I pose that question to you now, you'd go, well, I don't know. I should put it up. Maybe I could have made a fire. I could have rubbed a couple of sticks. Like, you know, whatever. I could have waited. I could have had something to eat. The list goes on and on and on. But when you're actually in that situation and you're in the moment, like you're embedded in that moment, and you still have the, you know, you're still lucky enough to be able to make a decision, then the decision is very easy. And that's always been my own, like understanding when to quit is really important. Quitting is important. It's not that, you know, just having your head down and, you know, full steam ahead, regardless of, you know, damn the torpedo sorts of thing is ridiculous. It's interesting that you didn't, and when you're describing that, you didn't hesitate at all. I couldn't put up the tent. My hands were too cold. I knew if I kept walking, because you can walk for a very long time. You can keep going, right? But as soon as you lay down, then you start to get cold, like right now. So yeah, it was amazing that you made that. To me, it sounded like you made that decision very, very quickly. And then the miracle of it all, I mean, not just the fact that you survived, of course, because that's miraculous in itself. On a big scale, but on a much smaller scale, you need to look at your app. You've had no phone connection for weeks, and suddenly it works for the 2 minutes you need, then shuts off. Like, how is that? How is that? You can't say I'm going to walk around like this with your phone until I have cell phone coverage. And yeah, so I think that's that was beautiful.
Thoroughly enjoyed listening to Bert's stories and actually hearing what it sounds like to navigate the entire globe and travel the Indian Ocean and see six story waves. I mean, at the end of our conversation, I thought, that is an adventure that I'm gonna skip. I mean, I can walk across France without speaking the language, but alone on a boat for months and months on end, and then those six-story waves that we talked about, yeah, I'm gonna skip all that. But it's a good thing that we have people like Bert in the world, because he is the one that goes out and has these adventures for us, and then he comes back and tells us his tales. There will be a link in the episode show notes so you can click on that and find out a little bit more about this intrepid traveler, this intrepid adventurer. As this year is winding down, I want to thank each and every one of you for all the love that you've shown the podcast this year and all the love that you've shown me. It has been an extremely challenging year, filled with lots and lots of unexpected surprises and needs to move from place to place. And frankly, sometimes I look back on this year and I wonder how I actually got a podcast out each and every week. I am very aware that lots and lots of people, including many of my dear friends, have had the years from hell. And so I think we're all looking forward to 2025 and hopefully better times. Although that is to be determined because we know what's happening in January. Thank you for listening. And here's my one request. Be like Bert. Be an adventurer.
I mean, really, honestly, like we joked about laying on the couch and getting up and going to work out, but I mean, there's your front door. And you could just walk to your front door and open it, because the second that you cross that threshold and the second you go into the outside world, all bets are off and any adventure is yours for the taking. So be like Bert, get up off the couch, roll off the couch, crawl off the couch, whatever that looks like, put on your shoes, put on your jacket, and then go to your front door, turn the knob, and then step across the threshold, because you never know what's waiting out there in the world for you.